show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. It probably feels to you all that it's been a little bit longer, about 3 weeks since we've had our last show. And last week, we truly did not record, but the week before, I spent roughly 4.5 hours meticulously dissecting everything Jason Hamill has ever done in his entire life. And we laid it bare for the public to judge on the podcast, and it wouldn't be a season on the Kansas City Baseball Vault without some podcasting gremlins, and they released that podcast to the ether. So unfortunately, you'll never hear our what would surely be Pulitzer Prize winning work on the story of Jason Hamill, although I'm not certain there's a Pulitzer Prize for podcasting, whatever the equivalent for podcasting would be. If there was, we'd win it for that.
We would have had it been the the monologue alone was, I think, some of our finest work. Anytime you can do iambic tetrameter is, I mean, that's just cause for celebration right there.
It's true. We actually had the paperwork filled out to add visuals to it and submit it to the Academy for documentary feature consideration. Yeah. But, you know, some things are just never meant to be. We've got some other moves to talk about that have happened in the last couple of weeks besides just the Jason Hamill signing. So we'll kind of get into that. But first, I am Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is the unseasonably warm Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this unseasonably warm evening here in the
West? I wish it wasn't unseasonably warm. You know, I like a good 70-degree day like anybody else, like any other red-blooded American, but the thing about the building that I work in is it's very old. And so in order to regulate the temperature there, you basically need 2 days of lead time to change from heating to cooling and cooling to heating. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a week like this where you have 70 degrees, mid 70s, I think you even got up close to 80. I mean, we can't just flip on a switch and heat a 6-story building, and you run the AC through it all and make it better. So, it's a little bit warm at work. I can get home and be in my happy air conditioned place. And, so that's kind of ever since I've been home, that's pretty much what I did. Threw on some shorts and pumped up the AC.
At which point you realize, well, we've got the air conditioner turned on in February.
Right. And I've had the air conditioner on more often from November to now than the heat. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make sense at all. I have like big windows on one side, and so it really does a really good job of letting sunlight in, which can generally sustain for most of the time. So I'm kind of fortunate in that, so that even when it's been colder, I don't necessarily have to do the heat. And I'm second floor too, so that helps. But yeah, still.
Yeah. Good thing global warming is fake. Otherwise,
I'd be worried. But phew, we dodged a bullet.
It's very convenient that we don't have to worry about that.
If we ever do, though.
Man.
Yeah.
I hope we're prepared.
Yeah, right. Can't imagine what it's going to be like.
Anyway.
Back to baseball.
Not possibly, man.
We didn't even get on the rails before we got off the rails.
No, we just started
like,
off.
Screw it. We're like the hobo running alongside the tracks trying to hop onto the train.
Exactly. It's the train's already moving.
It's gone. It's left the station.
It's out of there, and we're left wandering with a stick with a sack tied to the end of it that probably doesn't hold.
I used to do that when I was little. I'd be like 6 years old and get ticked off at something. I didn't get my way, and I would put a pillowcase on the end of like a broomstick and put a box of cereal in the pillowcase and tie it to the broom, and I'd go hide in the closet and say I ran away.
I used to do the same thing. I would go and I would get like a little, I had a Transformers bag, and I would run down to the end of the street, and there was like a little brick thing at the corner of the street, you know, just like a little display or whatever to look nice. And I would just like sit behind it so that if my parents looked outside the door, they wouldn't be able to see me anywhere. So thought I was super clever at the time.
Anyway, let's
funny story. If you're ready for this, if we may delay the rails one more time. So I actually, believe it or not, tried to actually pack like I actually would be running away, right? So I put like clothes in there, including underwear, right? So I leave, I go hang. It's like, you know, felt like an hour, but I mean, I was a little kid. It's like
probably
I was like eight or so. As I'm sitting behind this thing, and my mom comes down the street and she's like, "Jeff, come back home." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." So come home. And then the next day I had these friends that lived down the street from me, and we were close enough to our school that we could walk. So we walked home from school. And as we walked by that corner to turn up to our street, there was a pair of my underwear sitting still caught in the bushes. It must have fallen out of my bag, and it was just proudly on display. So it had been on display like that whole day, and found it when we were walking home. So that was sufficiently embarrassing. But, you know, these are the things that make you who you are as a person.
Character building.
It's right, because now here I am telling you all about it.
No fear.
So, indeed. With that, we can actually
get into baseball. It's a good idea.
You know, it's one underwear story is enough.
Yeah, I agree.
So
we've hit our quota for the year.
So yes. So we did talk about Jason Hamill, but now that that's gone, we don't need to rehash everything we discussed, but you know, we can kind of hit on it a little bit. The gist, correct me if I'm wrong, feel free to add something to this. The gist of our conversation was not lighting the world on fire with the Jason Hamill signing, but it's very good. It made sense before Yordano Ventura to really bolster the rotation. Almost became imperative after Yordano Ventura's tragic death. So Jason Hamill was signed by the Royals, and 2-year deal. Nothing that's going to destroy the team, but you know, it's probably a deal that you wouldn't necessarily have thought the Royals could get for him, you know, last year. And probably not even at the beginning of the offseason. He was probably the best pitcher at the on the market available at the time. So, you know, pretty solid deal. Nothing you're going to say, oh, man, I hate this deal. Why would they ever do that? But nothing that you're going to be like, oh, now the Royals are for sure contenders. You know, did I nail the pertinent parts?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, he kind of got caught in a weird market. And it's been a weird offseason and weird free agent market for most players. But Royals got him for 2 years and $16 million. I think we looked up and MLB trade rumors had projected him to be like 3 years and $42 million. So, you know, if that's to be believed as a fair assessment of his market value, Royals got a pretty good deal. You know, and he's not going to be a workhorse. You know, he's probably good for about 170 innings or so, but he'll usually be able to make about 30 starts a year. The one thing that I kind of looked at, you know, as we've talked about him here and there, you know, he did fade a little bit in the summer months last year. I looked at, you know, April through June, he had one start where he didn't make it through five innings. In the second half, July through October, he had four such starts. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to be a trend that we'll see this year. It could also be that he was on a team managed by Joe Maddon, who's not afraid to just go yanking guy. Ned Yost is a lot more patient, or maybe has less of a quick hook. So that may get him more innings this year. You know, he may see more time where he actually gets through five or six innings. and isn't pulled at the first sign of trouble. So I think he'll help the rotation. He's a talented guy. He, you know, has been able to start pretty much at a league average level, and the last couple of years has been a little bit better. So with a good defense behind him, a big ballpark, you know, I think it's a good fit for both Jason Hamill and for the Royals. So I was pretty pleased when they made that announcement. And just personality-wise, he seems like he fits in too. So Joel Goldberg tweeted earlier today that he was talking to Hamill, and Hamill was like, yeah, I set this up like a couple of years ago. I threw a cookie to Sal Perez and you know, wanted to endear myself to my future teammates. Of course, Hamill was the guy who gave up the walk-off hit in the wild card game in 2014. So,
right.
You know, and he's kind of a humorous guy in that kind of way. So he should fit right in, and should be able to pitch pretty well too. So, I approve.
Yes, approve indeed. So with that, you know, we won't, don't need to spend too much more time discussing that, but we have a litany of other moves that have been made. Royals have actually been quite busy the last couple of weeks. You know, it started with the Jason Hamill move, and since then, in no particular order, Peter Moylan has been signed again to a 1-year deal. Seth Maness or Sean Maness?
Seth Maness is actually.
Seth. Yep. Maness is how it's pronounced.
I did have to look that up because I've heard it both like multiple ways, and Maness
versus Maness. Yep. So it's pronounced Maness like a.
Yeah.
Moving on. Yep. So Seth Maness, who was formerly of the Cardinals organization, and actually the interesting thing about him, you and I were just discussing this before we went live, he had an experimental – what's the surgery called?
You know, it's basically –
does
it
have a name
really
yet?
Have a name?
Could it be the Maness surgery at some
maybe
point?
Maybe. It's technically a UCL repair with internal brace construction. But the article, and the article is by Derek Gould of St. Louis paper, really interesting that they published it about a month ago. The medical code that they do when you go in for the surgery is the same as Tommy John surgery. And they didn't even know that he would be a candidate for it until they actually got into the elbow. So it's basically from the article, the doctor performing it, they have to basically assess the health of the remaining ligament. Typically in Tommy John surgery, you're going to remove the damaged ligament, replace it with one from your wrist or maybe from your leg, you know, and basically start with an entirely new ligament in your elbow. Obviously that level of intrusion, you know, it's 12 to 18 months, sometimes 2 years recovery. With this surgery, it's basically, they were able to tell that the ligament was A, in good shape, other than the tear, you know, obviously, and that the tear was located close enough to the bone that basically they can set up like a, you know, kind of a tape. They almost tape it back together and it heals itself. And so that surgery took place in mid-August, and he's already throwing again and maybe ready for opening day. So, you know, to basically have a tear and to be at a point where you can actually contribute within the next season, you know, that's pretty revolutionary. There haven't been a lot of these done yet. So I think the doctors performed about 50 of them on high school, college, and a couple of pros. So we'll see how it goes. But if it's, you know, as the kind of the medicine catches up and evolves, I mean, this could be something that saves months, you know, and contributes months more to baseball careers. But it does sound like it's not a completely new surgery so much as it's like an adjustment on the current typical Tommy John. So, I mean, I don't know how I'd really characterize it, but it's certainly interesting, you know, just to see an alternate method of, you know, repairing the elbow And if Maness can be, you know, the whole point of his, he was non-tendered by the Cardinals, so they didn't offer him a contract, and that's why he was able to sign with the Royals, because they didn't want to have to pay him his first year of arbitration and have him be rehabbing through it. And now, lo and behold, through this, you know, new surgery, new procedure, he may be able to contribute on day one. Probably not. I think he's got an opt-out into mid-May or maybe late May, so the Royals may just take their time, see how he actually looks on the mound. I didn't see that he was slated to be pitching in the first round of spring training games or inter-squad or anything, so they may just be taking their time with him. But, you know, he's somebody who you could see him contribute for 4 or 5, maybe all 6 months of the season if he's throwing well, feeling good, and feeling healthy. So it's pretty remarkable, really cool story. I'll try to remember to link it when we post this, because I think it's, if you're interested at all in, like, arm health and Tommy John surgery and injuries and things like that, I think it's really interesting. And aside from that, Maness is, you know, he's like almost 60% ground ball rate for his career, so he can be really effective whenever he's ready. He had a 120 ERA plus, primarily out of the bullpen, with the Cardinals at the big league level, a 1.7 walks per nine innings rate. And he in the minor leagues, in 252 and two-thirds innings, he walked a total of 19 batters. So he's got really great command and control. He doesn't throw that hard, but he's got a lot of sink. And that's really where it works out. Like, he can get a lot of ground balls and he doesn't walk guys. And you can get by with that. So if that control is there, if the sink is still on there, he can be probably a really effective reliever for the Royals and basically just kind of fell into their laps. So I think he's a really interesting signing.
Yeah, no, that's very intriguing. And that's a really interesting story. I completely agree. Like, you know, it's as big of an issue as Tommy John surgery the UCL has been, and as prevalent as Tommy John surgery has become as a result. It's, you know, if there can be a new method like this, and, you know, it sounds like not every scenario would be a candidate for it, but, you know, even if it's half the Tommy John surgeries, if you can come back in 6 months instead of 18 months, I mean, that's huge. You know, then you're basically talking, I mean, you know, it's you, depending on when the injury happened, you know, you might lose, you know, half to three quarters of a season. And, you know, as opposed to, you know, you look at Jason Vargas, you know, losing all of a chunk of 2015, all of 2016, and then now he's back. So, you know, it's so much harder to come back from, because you know, they say you can come back from Tommy John after about 12 months, but that a true, you know, recovery would be 18 months. You know, Greg Holland, same deal. You know, he was it August of 2015 for him, right?
I mean, they had the surgery somewhere in there, yeah.
I mean, and it was, you know, the injury happened.
Yeah, he'd
well
been pitching on basically a flat tire for who knows how long, maybe the whole season. He might have just been, I can't even imagine.
Well, you could see from the beginning that he wasn't right that season, and he was still getting it done for the most part. You know, he wasn't as dominant as
he was.
He
was better than average
in 2014, but he was, you know, still a top half of the league
with no
closer
elbow.
With exactly as you said,
with
on a flat tire. So that's the amount of pain he must have been in is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So kudos to him for getting that done. But, you know, if you can, but
even with that,
if that was August when he had the surgery, then he missed, you know, from there on in 2015, all of 2016. And, you know, he signed with the Rockies in this offseason, so he'll be back in 2017. But
we still don't know how he's going to look.
Full season and a chunk. Exactly. That's a full season and a chunk of another season that was missed. So if you know, and given the same scenario, Greg Holland could have been back for 2016 if he was eligible for the surgery like Maness was, and had had the surgery and been in August, and he, you know, possibly what could have been ready for a large portion of the season last year. So, you know, it's really kind of, it'll be interesting to follow, to not only see if Maness can come back and continue pitching, but doing it at a major league caliber level. So that'll be one of the more interesting stories to watch as we move along. So past the Maness signing, we have Travis Wood, who was signed by the Royals as well. We'll just kind of go through the list here, and then we can kind of pick out piece by piece what we want to talk about. Brian Peña signed again by the Royals to a minor league deal. Brian Flynn actually fell through the roof of a bar. And so now he got shifted to the 60-day DL, so he comes off the 40-man. Alec Mills, minor league pitcher that many people were actually excited about, he got traded for Donnie DeWeese. I'm pronouncing that one right?
I think so.
Donnie DeWeese from the Cubs, right?
A lot of Cubs action this offseason.
A lot of Cubs.
You got Solaire. You got Jason Hamels.
Jorge Solaire. DeWeese. The Royals are trying to recreate that 2016 Cubs team. Not a bad idea.
No, if they can go sneak Chris Bryan over, that'd be great too. Probably.
Sure. Yeah, you know what? Why the hell not? Let's see. And with that, okay, so those are pretty much all the major moves that they've
made. Yeah.
For that, you know, we've talked about Maness being Travis Wood is in my opinion probably from that list the next biggest signing and probably the one that could have the most impact. And he's a guy that he can bolster the bullpen pretty well. He can fight for the rotation if they need him to. You know, he's another one of those. He and Nathan Carnes, I think, are really going to kind of be in that role. I mean, from what you know, from what you've kind of heard, what do you think? How do you think between those two, that's going to kind of, you think one or the other has the leg up on the rotation right now? If it's me, I feel like Carnes has probably the inside track to that five spot. But, you know, then as some people you hear kind of think that Royals maybe view him more in that Wade Davis mold, which might make you think they're leaning towards, you know, putting him in the bullpen. So
Carnes has like that mid-90s fastball. He's got that good curveball that we've talked about, you know, back when he was acquired. You know, he moved to the bullpen last year by the Mariners. But I would, you know, when you compare these two, what kind of gets me with Travis Wood is that the last 2 years he's primarily been a reliever after starting. And the Royals say that they've signed him to have him compete for a rotation spot. But you look at his splits, and they really do not lend themselves very well to a starting pitcher, especially when most batters are right-handed and he's a lefty. You know, he's really tough on left-handed batters. Last year, he allowed a 447 OPS against lefties. OPS? Like, that's pretty ridiculous. But it was like 900 against righties. Sharp Ooh, difference.
Not as ridiculous.
Ridiculous in a different way. You know, he doesn't throw that hard. He throws about 90, 91. He really is more of like a fastball cutter slider type, which you can imagine why he's tough on lefties. You know, if he can locate the fastball inside and then everything else is moving away from the lefties, well, that's going to be tough. But he's basically scrapped his changeup as he's gone into more and more relief work, which if he considers that his worst pitch, well, that's not going to help him when he has to face right-handed hitters as a starter. So I would think that, you know, that is going to make him more of a lefty, maybe not a specialist. He can probably get by facing the random righty, or if you have like a left, right, left, or, you know, left, left, right, left, you know, whatever combination where he might have to face a righty. But if you're asking him to go through a lineup two or three times where six of the nine guys in the lineup, or they'd probably even stack to where like eight of the nine would be right-handed, that could be pretty rough. And I feel like Carnes probably has the better stuff to get through more, you know, to get through that kind of a platoon split. you know, I think he has maybe more upside as a starter than Woodward. I mean, I think those are probably the two guys it'll come down to. I mean, Chris Young is maybe in the mix, Matt Strom possibly in the mix, but I feel like they're comfortable with Strom being that kind of back end relief option. Chris Young, I really think they don't want to do anything with him in the rotation unless they have to. So I think, yeah, it probably does come down to Carnes or Travis Wood, and I would definitely lean Carnes. I don't know that, yeah, they signed Wood, and you know, he should be capable. But I can't imagine with those kind of splits that it's a good idea to try him as a starter. So we'll see how he pitches in spring training. Maybe if he gets the changeup back, maybe if they make some adjustments, that can change things. But, you know, I don't know that he's got anything that can really work against righties. And if he doesn't have that, he really shouldn't start.
Since you brought it up, I'm going to ask you a question here. This is not related to any of the signings, but you talk about Matt Strom. You talk about how the Rose are comfortable with him in kind of a back-end role, seventh inning, eighth inning, you know, who knows. But so here's the question, okay? With Matt Strom, there's always been, you know, last year it was kind of like, oh, he's doing great as a reliever. He could factor into the rotation next year. I feel like we've heard this song and dance before. So do you think the Royals really view him as someone who can start and who they're grooming to be a starter, a la Danny Duffy and his time in the bullpen? Or, you know, Zach Greinke, when he came back in 2007 and he started out in the bullpen, you know, are they looking along those lines, you think? Or do you think it's more of a Aaron Crow, Brandon Finnegan type scenario where, like, yeah, you know, he could be a starter and we're going to, you know, have him train like one, but, you know, bullpen will
as soon
take
as it gets
priority.
Tough, you just shuttle him back.
Yeah, how do you think the team's gonna, because I really, it's hard for me to get a read on them. And obviously we know, you know, like from the rumblings that, you know, like David Leskie and Clint Scholes have given us, but I still don't know where I come out on that. Like, how do you feel the organization is handling
I mean
that?
It seems like right now they're in a spot with Strom where they know they want to kind of monitor his innings. You know, we saw that last year over the last month where there were a bunch of times where they could have used him and they did not because they just didn't want to overdo it. You know, he's got some injury history. The thing that I think separates Strom from guys like Aaron Crow and guys like Brandon Finnegan is that the thing with Crow was, like, he always had a good fastball and he had a good slider, but he never got his changeup going and he never had another breaking pitch. You know, he never even worked on anything so much as, like, a cutter. So there was really only a choice between two pitches when he was on the mound. He never really had that third one that he could go for. And Finnegan was a lot of the same way, where, you know, fastball, slider, he kind of had a thing of a changeup. And he's, you know, definitely is probably going to start some this season. But when, you know, considering where they were about the same kind of point, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't sit there and say that Finnegan was somebody that the Royals were really committed. And obviously, you can see how they used him. They said, yeah, he's going to start. And then it was like, nope. You know, first week of April, they call him up to hit the bullpen. And as soon as he hit the bullpen, it was basically done with that experiment. But with Strom, I think that it's more along the lines of they're going to see what he can do. And right now, the bullpen is his best spot. But he's got the stuff, I think, to be more of a starter than you know, some of those other guys. He's got the good fastball, he's got that really good curveball, and he's got a good changeup. And according to Clint Scholes, I don't remember where he picked this up, but, like, there's talk about working on a slider that he didn't Strom never really threw that last year. But if he adds that, I mean, that could be, you know, two plus pitches, one good pitch, and add a slider that could be good. And that's where you start to see, okay, you know, maybe in the second half of the year, you see if he can start. Maybe you just use him out of the bullpen and then start him next year when maybe it's a little less, you know, cluttered in the rotation. You know, Chris Sale pitched out of the bullpen for a while before he actually hit a rotation too. You know, just because they wanted to use him to max effectiveness out of the bullpen, and then when it was time, they moved him as a starter. Not to say that Strom's going to be Chris Sale, but that it's, you know, it's not unheard of with guys who have the stuff. They just might use him in a different role before they put him in that thing. So if it was me, I don't think Strom's going to start unless the Royals are out of it late, or maybe in the second half. But I think eventually he'll get transitioned to where he can be at least given the shot to be a starter, you know, and not like an Aaron Crow, Brandon Finnegan shot, but like a, here's 10 starts, here's 15 starts, you know, let's see what you can do. Cause I think his stuff will play against lefties and righties. You know, even someone like Brian Flynn, who had a good season last year, really underrated and under the radar good season out of the bullpen, you know, still they never really felt like they were going to give him any kind of chance to start. And, you know, Strom, I just think he's different. I think he's got a lot more special. And even if he's just going to be a reliever this year, you know, quote, just a reliever for this kind of team. Yeah, I think he'll start. I think he'll start, if not this year, next year, and could probably be pretty good at it with all that stuff.
So you think this is a legitimate goal for the organization and not just lip service? Because there was no – I never felt like the Royals truly considered Aaron Crow as a starter. I felt more like it was for his benefit that they were just letting him pretend to kind of like, I'm going to warm up with the starters, guys.
It's like,
hey guys,
it's like playing Nintendo, you know, with the controller unplugged with your younger cousin or younger sibling or something. It's like, oh, look
right,
what you
exactly.
did.
Yeah.
You're Mario.
That's so
good
awesome.
Job.
So good. Oh, wow. You started a whole 2 innings in spring
good
training,
for you.
Aaron Crow. You're going to be a starter someday.
Yeah, so. I think it's more than that. I think –
And I do agree that Strom appears to be a different type of pitcher than they are, than the examples we mentioned. So that, you know, bodes in his favor for being.
I mean, they talked at different points, like back in before 2011, they were like, hey, maybe Greg Holland could be a starter, and then it was like, nah. Kyle Farnsworth, when he was around, they were like, oh, he might be a starter. No, he was. No, I think it's just
Joaquin Soria.
Yeah, right.
He still has starting incentives in his current contract.
So I just don't. I think that they, you know, if someone has any chance to start, they may as well look at them. But yeah, I mean, you can kind of tell if a guy only has 2 pitches, you're not going to see them really get a shot to start. It's just you got to have that third pitch at least to show. You know, it's and really it has to be more than just a show pitch, and Strom has that. I just think they don't want to try to throw him out there for 150 innings until they can see what he can do. And he probably right now probably is more effective out of the bullpen anyway. So, you know,
yeah. And it just may be one of those scenarios where it fit the fit on this team, just the way it's constructed, just so happens to be more of a bullpen role. So, cause I mean, if after last season, I think you have a good enough, idea of what you're going to get from Strom out of the bullpen to know what you can likely expect over the course of a season. You know, maybe he goes a little up or down from where he was, but you know, you got enough of a sample size last year that I think you can kind of say, okay, we know what we have here. But the starter Matt Strom at the major league level is a wild card. We don't know what that is yet and what he is yet in that role. So it's easier to say, okay, Nathan Carnes, we have a better idea of what he is in that role. You know, Travis Wood, we have a better idea what he is in that role if they decided to go that route as well. So, you know, those you can feel a little bit more comfortable going there and putting Matt Strom in like a seventh inning role where he's actually really valuable versus, you know, if you have, say, Nathan Carnes turns out to be just not all that great, you know, 4.7 ERA type of a thing. If Matt Strom is that same way, then, you know, you have him, but then you put Carnes in the bullpen and you don't know what you're going to get from Carnes. Maybe he blows a game in the seventh inning that Strom wouldn't have, you know. So these are the kind of things that you can play around with, but especially early in the season when it seems like it's so important to get off to a good start, you know, you want to have as many known commodities as possible and put them in the best position to succeed.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you start out the season and you've got, you know, Cody and Rara closing games, Soria backing him up in the eighth, Strom coming out in the seventh. You know, sorry is a different discussion that we'll have later. But, you know, if that's the a realistic possibility of what the back end of your bullpen will look like. So, excuse me. So if that's what you end up with, you know, then you might be okay. You might be, you know, that might help you win a couple close games early on in the season. And for this Royals team specifically, I think they've shown that, you know, getting off to a fast start is of relative importance. Yeah.
And this year in particular, since, you know, if they're, ten games below or something, I mean, that's probably a lot, you know, but if they're at that point in July, well, you know, you're looking to next year, you're looking to rebuild, you're seeing what Lorenzo Cain gets you and other guys in trades at that point. So if they don't get off to a good start, yeah, it might be just like a countdown to when guys start getting traded off. So yeah, it's a good point.
I mean, if they start off 10-18,
yeah, then, yeah, oh god,
man, it's game over.
Oh, that'd be so sad.
But, oh man, that'd be like back to the days. And well, anyway, but before there's a little piece relevant to that. Excuse me, that we'll talk about here in a minute.
Right.
But while we're on the pitching staff, a couple of the things that we can mention. Now the pitchers and catchers have reported. We got spring training, kind of starting up here. We're gonna talk about there's lots of talk about on the radio and different areas about, you know, your early observations from spring training. Both local radio stations have representatives out there. They're getting interviews, they're getting, you know, firsthand things that they see, they're reporting back to the different shows. So a couple of things. Okay. First, we'll save this one to second. We'll go with the new guy first. So new guy being Josh Stalmont. Mm-hmm. So lots of talk about him recently. Part of it is because, you know, he's starting to get a little bit more chatter in the prospect list for both the Royals org. And, you know, he's not like a top 100 prospect or anything, but, you know, national people are starting to take notice. And it's because he's one of those guys with the quote unquote live arm. Yep. Type of a thing. He gets that triple digits with the fastball, kind of reminiscent of Yordano Ventura, almost what it sounds like. I haven't seen Stalmont pitch, so I don't know what, you know, if he looks like that or anything, but just in terms of, you know, the stuff you hear and the kind of the what you've heard about him coming up. But, you know, unlike Ventura, Stalmont has had incredibly worse battles with his command. And in 123 innings last year, he gave up 104 walks.
That's a lot.
So, I mean, I haven't done the math on that, but that's roughly eight walks per nine innings. So, I mean, that's not good.
He is the anti-Manus.
Yes, anti-Manus, exactly. Would that make him the but the flip side on the Stalmont conversation to the 104 walks and 123 innings is in those same amount of innings, he had 167 strikeouts. So, you know, now you're talking like, you know, a 10.0 strikeouts per nine, roughly. I don't know.
It's a lot. That's a lot of strikeouts. I mean, it's impressive number of strikeouts.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, legit top end numbers even for a prospect. So say he would have cut those, even if he would have just cut those walk numbers in half, say he had 54 instead of 104 walks, he would have been a top 50 prospect.
I mean, that's about 3-1 strikeout to walk ratio. So
yeah, exactly. So, you know, and then you're still, you know, you're still looking at, you know, an above 4 walk per nine metric, but that's at least something you can manage, something you can work with. You know, when you're up into that 7 or 8 category, it's not a feasible thing for you to be a major league pitcher if you're walking that many guys, no matter how many strikeouts you make. I mean, that leads you to being,
you're walking a guy an inning, really,
a reliever at best. Yeah, so you're essentially You know, he basically appears to be a fan of the new extra inning rule where they start a man on second. He's just going to start him on first, right. You know, just we'll give you a free batter every inning. But seriously, though, you know, and when you I heard it was Thorne Petro on the show. He had an interview with Stalmont that I heard on my lunch break. And he, you know, afterwards he said, you know, there is some legit concerns on Stalmont's ability to rein in his command. However, you know, if you can try and parse that out, you know, he's like, it's always kind of a fool's errand, if you will, to do this and try and say, hey, here's a ceiling for a pitcher and give an example of it. You know, and the example that Petro gave, and he's not the only one that I've heard, is a Zach Greinke type, but with the stuff that he has and kind of the way he view, everyone calls him, uses the cerebral term for Stalmont, you know, and you know, Zach Greinke was, he's kind of a, he's his own.
He's on his own animal, island, kind of in and, a way. Yeah. You
know, but he was always a guy, you know, similar to, not quite as in depth, but similar to like a Brian Bannister, you know. Greinke was a guy who was very much he paid attention to the statistics. He paid attention to a lot of the little things in pitchers that, you know, a lot of guys at that talent level, they don't necessarily pay attention.
They don't
to
have
things.
To.
They just go out. They just have this natural ability. They just get people
go
out.
Go and shove and see what happens. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I don't know. You know, that's how I kind of view someone like a David Price. He just goes out there and he's like, I'm just going to just get this past you and there's nothing you can do about it, you know, and that's, if you've got the talent to do that, then absolutely that's great. But you know, beyond just the mental comparison, you know, the stuff comparison as well, you talk about Zach Greinke's ceiling, and again, you know, it is kind of a fool's errand to do that, but at the same time it's relevant to show, okay, here's a guy who the talent that's there, you know, here's their ceiling. Like, there was a guy I remember a couple years ago who had a really good season in, you know, like Double A or something. Greg Bilo. What, you remember that guy?
Yeah, Mike? Yeah.
He never made it past Double A, but he had a really good season, you know, with like a 2 point something ERA. And everyone was like, well, maybe this guy could be something, you know. A guy like that, he had like an 89 mile an hour fastball or whatever it was. So a guy like that, you know, his ceiling is Jason Vargas, you know, so when you're someone who, and Jason Vargas is a very good pitcher in major leagues, but he's nothing special, you know? So the relevance there is to show, okay, if everything 100% clicks and a prospect becomes everything they possibly can be, this is the ceiling they can reach. That never happens. You know, that, I mean, it happens with guys like Zach Greinke or David Price or something, you know, those very once in a, once in a long while type situations. So you know, that's very rare. But even still, then if you say, okay, well, if Stalmont never reaches that level, maybe he's at 70-80%, you know, and this is the point that Petro was making, then that's still a pretty good pitcher. You know, you're still getting major league value out of that. He's going to fit in somewhere in your organization if he can get to that level. You know, but I mean, it's possible that, you know, he becomes 50% and he just flames out. And he never gets here. You know, he never reigns in that command. One of the interesting things he mentioned about the control issues was that he talked to one of the pitchers at camp pitching coaches at camp. And I was in my car on lunch break when I was listening to this, and I actually went into the store. And then when I came back out, he was like in the middle of the story. So I didn't hear exactly the name of the coach he was talking to, if he even mentioned what the name of the coach was. But anyway, and the word on Stalmont to him, this is the coach talking to Petro, was that the problem is, and maybe this is even Stalmont himself talking to Petro. I didn't hear exactly who it was from, but I thought it was a coach. Anyway, what they said was Stalmont's issue is that he just kind of loses it for 10 to 15 pitches, you know, and so he'll walk 2-3 guys right in a row, you know. So it reminds me kind of the way Danny Duffy was in that like 2020 time frame.
Sounds similar.
So, yeah. And so it's like, you know, you just and then it would snap back on and he'd be okay. And he'd pitch like normal. But, you know, you just, at the major league level, you just cannot afford to do that. So, you know, if that can happen, if he can cut that down to, you know, losing it from 10 to 15 pitches to losing it from, you know, 6 to 8 pitches that he loses it, you know, then maybe it's only a batter, batter and a half instead of 2 or 3 batters, you know, so who knows if any of this will ever happen. People seem to be kind of jumping on this train and hoping if, and at the very least, he appears to have good enough stuff that, you know, he can be kind of a bullpen piece. And if he can at least harness that control in, maybe you say, okay, well, you know, you're not good enough. You know, you're still going to give us 5 or 6 walks per 9 innings, and we can't accept that. But, you know, you can come in a scenario and you might strike out the side and walk one person or something. You know, that's a little bit more acceptable risk, if you will. So, so I don't know. I'm cautiously optimistic on what I've been hearing about Stalmont. I don't know that he, you know, 2017 will necessarily be his year, yeah. But as we have to look past the possible mass exodus of 2017, he's kind of a name that's cropped up a little recently that's been a little bit more exciting. I mean, are you with me there, or are you a little bit more tempered than I am on the Stalmont hype train that is slowly starting to
turn? I think he's interesting.
Along.
I mean, the guy can throw like 102, so I mean that's immediately that's interesting if you're a pitcher. I mean, I don't know that he's going to do much this year for the big league team. I mean, there's been some talk of, okay, maybe he'll start the season in the bullpen, and they very well may do that. But he only pitched as high as double A, you know, last year, and that was even half a season. So I think they'd rather – he's someone kind of like how we talked with Strom, you know, if they feel like he can be a starter, you find a guy like that, and you want to see if he can really start. And if that means that he has to be in the minors, then so be it. Now, if he comes out and his control is good in spring training and he's throwing hard and he looks sharp, they can always start him in the bullpen, see how he does at the big league level. If he succeeds, keep him there. If he doesn't, then you can try it out. And maybe next year you try him as a starter or something. I don't know. I think he's definitely interesting. There's a good reason why he's one of the top Royals prospects, you know, because there is talent there. This may not be the year for him, but you know, he's worth keeping an eye on. I mean, there's a non-zero chance that they would go with it just because, you know, the stuff is so apparent. And, you know, worst case is you might try him for like 2 weeks in low leverage spots to see what he can do. If he does something, maybe move him up to tighter spots. If he keeps doing well, keep moving him up. If he doesn't do well, you always send him down. You know, that's always, you know, he's got plenty of time to figure some stuff out in the minors. So, you know, I thought the comparison that you were going to bring up was going to be to like Randy Johnson, who was really, really wild when he was coming up too. Mm-hmm. Figured it out and still threw hard and struck out a ton of guys. It's unfair to compare any minor leaguer to any other guy, but you know, that's it. You know, it's not like guys, it's not unheard of for guys to suddenly find control, but you know, that's definitely the thing that you would look for in Stalmont, is to actually get that under wrap, you know, get it to that 4 walks per 9 and then just kind of keep chipping it away, yeah, I mean, and make it more effective.
And you've got, you know, Nolan Ryan.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, as you were talking, I pulled him up because I'd heard some stories. I think there was one no hitter that Nolan Ryan threw that he had 15 strikeouts and 7 walks, you know, so that's a lot of flipping pitches, because typically a strikeout and a walk are going to take more, yep, pitches than just, you know, a pop out or something. So,
well, and you couldn't hit, you know, Ryan. I mean, he was the hardest guy in baseball history to hit, probably by the numbers. So, right. I mean, you can get by. I mean, if you're someone who's just that unhittable, you can kind of make it work, but it's
because he had a career 4.7 walk per 9 inning ratio. That's for his
career.
What was
his hits per 9?
6-ish.
Yeah, 6.6. So, I mean, yep, that's pretty good.
There you go. So that's still a 1.24 whip with almost 5 walks, yeah, per game. or per nine innings, he's still only putting on, you know, 1.25 batters per
inning. Stalmont last year was 7.6 hits per nine innings in the minors, which is still pretty good for the minors, you know.
Yeah.
It'd be great in the big leagues then, as a rookie, but, you know, it's okay. It's fine. It's if he could get into that four range, and that'd be probably pretty good zone for him.
Yeah. And Ryan had a 9.5 strikeout per nine ratio for
really?
His
career. Well, different era. So, a lot of guys tried to very intently not strike out. He was more volume than rate.
Yeah.
Because he threw a bajillion freaking innings.
God, it's insane. Okay,
Did he have like 400 inning seasons? Did he get that high?
He had
300s.
No. Yeah. So, 1973. Good lord, he's pitched forever. 1973, he had 326 innings. Followed that up with 332 innings.
Just for perspective, Jason Hamble, the last 2 years as a full time starter, has thrown 336.2 innings. So that shows how the times have changed a little bit.
Yes, those were his two biggest seasons. That you know, I kind of thought he hit. He had more.
Well, he also pitched from like this, but, you know, 1969 to last year. So,
yeah, because he was on that 69 Mets team.
I think he's a rookie.
Really,
I mean,
good. They won the World Series, right? That was his. Let's see. He didn't. It wasn't the full season, so I don't know if that was actually technically his. You know, he had 134 innings pitched in 1968.
Okay.
And then he had 89 innings pitched in 69. So he was, let's see, games started 10. So he only spent, you know, he only started 10 games that year. So he was probably kind of a fireman, swingman type role for that team. But that's insane. The dude, I watched him pitch when I was alive, and he started pitching in 1968.
He started pitching before a man had walked on the moon. So, yeah.
But anyway.
Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah, walks,
So, point being, you know, it's possible to give up a lot of walks, but you got to be that unhittable.
No pressure, Josh Stalmont. Just be Zach Greinke, Nolan Ryan, and Randy Johnson.
Yeah, you know, no big deal.
Simple. But we'll see. I mean, I think he'll get something together and, you know, figure something out. The Royals will give him the opportunity because, again, how many guys can you find who can throw 102? It's not a lot.
Right. He had, looks like he had 11.6 strikeout per nine last year in Wilmington, and then 13.1 in Northwest Arkansas, which, you know, it's very small sample size in Northwest Arkansas there. So, well, 11 started games, so 11 games started still.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that's, again, the 7.6 walks per nine inning is not good.
No.
But if he can cut that in half.
Yeah.
Which is a tall order, I'm guessing. But if you could cut that in half and then, you know, even if he loses some strikeouts because of it, still maintains around a 10 strikeout per nine inning. I mean, then you've got yourself a pitcher right there.
And if it's the bullpen, you know, if he does work out of the bullpen, you can still live with that because, yeah, it's a high walk rate, but it's really only going to impact a game here and there. So, you know, it's just limited. It's not like walking four guys in a six-inning start or something. It's, you know, just you walk maybe two in one start, and then you've got enough to get through your inning, and you move on to the next one, and the next guy in the bullpen comes up. So it's, you know, it doesn't really hurt you. Or you hope it doesn't hurt you.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, it's a very good point because you're not, you know, you're putting one person on possibly through the course of a game instead of five or six. So outside of Stalmont, the guy that the non-new guy that we'll talk about, although it might feel
new.
There's
been an awakening. Can you feel it?
well said, sir. It's February, okay? Late February. It's almost March. This time next week, it will be March. And Kyle Zimmer is still throwing pitches. His arm, so far as I know, last I heard, as of earlier today, his arm is still connected to his body. So that is a positive. That's a plus.
A good starting point, yeah.
Yes, there are some whispers of optimisticness, I guess you could say, optimicity. I don't know what you call it.
Optimism.
some of these optimism. There we go. That's wow.
Totally well, on that word.
Optimism. I like optimism.
Optimicity. The Kyle Zimmer story.
Yes. It's optimism. wow. Total break.
Oh well.
Thank you. That's what you're here for.
It is.
Thank you. They don't call him the master for nothing, folks. So Kyle Zimmer, some whispers of optimism about how maybe, just maybe, the thoracic outlet syndrome surgery may have really been what was the issue all along. Right? I don't want to say it too loud.
You don't want to scare
the gods. I don't want to tempt fate with this one here. But those are the whispers. I'm not buying it.
Oh,
I've been burned too many times. Hell hath no fury, like a podcaster scorned. Will not catch me believing in Kyle Zimmer. No offense to Kyle Zimmer, the person. He seems like a perfectly affable and fine gentleman. But unfortunately, your athletic ability has been brought into doubt in the court of this podcaster's opinion. So until proven otherwise, I will not assume that the Rose get anything from Kyle Zimmer. But it's worth mentioning because there are people talking. And one of the things that I will say that's always been positive throughout all of this stuff with Kyle Zimmer is, in fact, his stuff, which even throughout all the injuries, whenever he's gotten back to the point recovering from an injury to where he can actually pitch, the stuff was always there. It never really seemed like coming back from injuries there was a, you know, like, oh, his stuff's not quite there yet. Most of the reports, it seems, from my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mike, but from my recollection, from what I've always heard, was that it was always there, and his stuff really never left him. So then if there's a positive to be maintained, it's that these kind of nagging injuries that have just kept him out year after year have not had any sort of adverse effects on his overall ability, which is key. And right now, I think you even hear national pundits saying, you know, what we see, what we hear, everything is just as good as it was when he was a top five draft pick, but we simply cannot give him the, you know, top 100 prospect type list notoriety because there's just absolutely no faith that he can be healthy. You know, that's even from a national perspective. They've essentially just – that's the nice way of saying we've moved on from this. Good luck. You know, so are you as pessimistic as I – as cautiously optimistic as I may be about Staumont, are you as pessimistic as I am about – or are you full of optimism – in regards
my,
to
my pessimisticity is lower. I'm kind of like, I mean, the caveat is of course that okay, you cannot count on this guy to do anything. I mean, he threw 5.2 innings last year. You know, he's really hasn't thrown over 100 innings since 2013. It's always one thing. It's either the shoulder or the back or the elbow or everything. So I get the skepticism. It's earned, it's warranted, it makes sense. I do kind of have this weird hunch. It's based literally on nothing other than, well, one, he's intact still. And two, that, you know, he's, like you said, the stuff is still there by all accounts. So if he can stay healthy, just big neon sign flashing lights. If he can stay healthy, maybe he does something this year. You know, I can't imagine anything bigger than a bullpen role, but if he pitches well and it all kind of holds up, like last year, I remember he looked okay in his first start, and then in his second start in spring training, he lost a lot off of his fastball, like dropped like 4 miles an hour, which that's not a good sign. You know, he didn't really do much. I mean, obviously 5.2 innings all season and was pretty much shut down. So if it turns out that this surgery, the thoracic outlet surgery, is what kind of does it and relieves all of the issues, The Royals might, you know, kind of stumble into a post-hype sleeper type of situation. You know, if he can give them 20 innings, 40 innings out of the bullpen at the big league level, and the stuff is able to continue to play, that's a pretty big get for the Royals. You know, just for this year, one, you get a guy with a pretty good arsenal who could help your bullpen. Two, you also have this hint of an idea of something you might have next year, and it might be a guy who, you know, by all accounts was a blue chip guy back in 2012 when he was drafted, you know, one of the better arms in that draft, and you know, high hopes for him. It could end up being something that you know, they might luck into, you know, finally figuring out what the issue was, correcting it, and having it work out. Now, that all being said, until he pitches a full season without significant issue, nobody's going to, you know, count on him, and nobody should count on him. Now, if he goes through and has like a hamstring strain or something and goes on a 15-day DL or whatever, that's not a big deal. But if it's like shoulder inflammation, tendonitis, you know, all these different things, then you kind of have to figure, okay, well, let's get what we can out of him. And anything at this point, anything you get out of him at the big league level is going to be just, you know, the gravy. It's just, you know, great. That's awesome. Same with like Bubba Starling, but we can talk about him later. You know, you get him to the big league, see if he can contribute, you know, but even if that, get him into AAA, get him pitching in AAA, get him pitching, you know, if he's out of the bullpen every, you know, a couple days a week, if he's in the rotation, have him take the mound and not skip a start. You know, that's where you're looking for the progress on him. And then if he can graduate into the big leagues, stay healthy, and the stuff, you know, sticks around where we think it will be, then okay, that's a fine. But yeah, I mean, there's, I guess the optimism is in what he can be still. The pessimism obviously is, you know, what it's always been. It's, you know, this guy gets hurt all the time. And until he doesn't get hurt, you know, you have to wonder when it's coming. And so, you know, I don't blame you for being off the train entirely, because there's only so much energy you can invest on some of these guys before you're like, all right,
I'm tapped, yeah, I'm tapped
and
out.
You're in Missouri. It's the show me state. He's got to show it. So it's just kind of got to work itself out to where he actually performs, hits the mound, stays healthy, and everything works. And if it does, the Royals are in good shape. If it's not, I don't think it's like going to shatter their plans, because they're probably in the same spot where it's like, all right, we want him to do something, but until he does something, we're not going to plan anything around him. And really, they, you know, again, they shouldn't. So I'm interested to see what happens. You know, I want to see that second start in spring training. I want to see, you know, how deep he gets into camp. You know, if he's pitching up to the last week, you know, he's someone you might see up and down a few times, or he might be a mainstay. I mean, I just, you know, or again, he might get hurt and nothing happens. So I want it to work. I want to believe. But yeah, I mean, it's still wait and see. It's going to be wait and see until he does something.
Yes, it absolutely is. So with that, we will wait and see if he does in fact do something or anything. And we'll move on to what'll be our final point here as we're heading into spring training. We've kind of talked about most of the moves. You know, I'm sure the Royals will make a pickup maybe here or there. You know,
small
one or
guy,
two
minor
more
league guy.
As we get closer to the season, maybe there's a spring training injury that they need to pick up somebody. But I think for the most part, they're kind of done making all their big noise. The Hamill, Wood signings are kind of the last, and Moss were kind of the last.
They're starting to get a bunch of pitchers lined up. So, I mean,
yeah, they are. I mean, I think they're stacking as many people as they can that can fill the fourth and or fifth starter roles, because I still think there's some possible uncertainty with Vargas. But regardless, you know, you try and you get enough that you can fill those roles. And then, you know, I think they're targeting, I think the Wade Davis experiment was something that they, you know, obviously worked out so well for them that I think they're targeting pitchers they know can kind of be like that. That's why you've got a Nathan Carnes and Travis Wood and those kind of guys that can, you know, upside is a solid starter, but you know, most likely outcome is very good relief.
And they traded Alec Mills, who
it's worked for
Alec
them in
Mills
the
doesn't profile as a guy who would be one of those Wade Davis type, you know, mid-90s fire breathing relievers.
Right.
He's, you know, lower 90s, more control than electric stuff, and that doesn't really work well. So if he wasn't going to be able to start, he was going to have less utility in the bullpen the way that the Royals typically have constructed theirs the last couple of years. So, you know, they get a minor league outfielder in Donnie Deweese. So it works out. So Mills probably going to go win a Cy Young with the Cubs, you know, because that's what happens.
It happens.
But that, you know, whatever. I mean, it makes sense now for them to make a move like that because of the way that they generally have been constructing their teams lately. So, you know, just to emphasize your observation there.
Yes, and so with that, we'll come to our final point here. So as all the moves have kind of settled in and spring training is up and running, it's now the question of, you know, kind of looking forward. And spring training is always that time where, since you get to see so many players beyond your strict 25-man major league roster, you kind of also get to have that eye towards the future, you know, because you can say, similar to a point you made kind of earlier about Stalmont, where Zimmer, where, you know, you see somebody and you can, you know, regardless of how much help they give you this year, you can get an inkling of what you may get in the future. And I think that's, you get the biggest picture of that in spring training, because, you know, not only do you get to see all these guys you don't normally see, but especially at the very beginning of spring training, you get to see them kind of, you know, against all, you know, against major league players. Now, the reason, you know, the point of all this being that with that eye towards the future, there's also some discussion of, you know, possible extensions or possible contracts being made to current players that are here. It's been a hot button issue. And for the last couple of years, ever since we've known, you know, it's 20, all those guys coming up at the same time and gelling to win a World Series is just obviously beyond awesome. But if there is a drawback to such a thing, it's that, well, if they all come up at the same time, they're all possibly leaving at the same time. You know, ideally, you'd like to stagger it so that you could hopefully work out some deals for them. But, you know, in the same year, the same offseason, it's just going to be impossible to pay them all. And all the players know that. This is not something that's been, you know, kind of brushed aside or not talked about. If they've been asked questions about it, they've discussed it openly. They all know this is the scenario. They know none of them are coming back. They all want to come back. And I seemingly genuinely believe that they all do want to come back. I don't know why you wouldn't. You just want a World Series here. But the big one that's going to get the most money on the free agent market, that's the biggest, you know, name, that's the face of the franchise right now, is Eric Hosmer. So, you know, the conventional wisdom will tell you, and we on this show, I think, are at a consensus that the, you know, historically speaking, and from the last couple of years, we'd say Eric Hosmer, Royal in 2018, not even close, right? It's not happening. This is not something that would happen in the world that we live in, you know. But Donald Trump is president.
Sure,
so anything is possible.
Do whatever anymore.
In the world that we currently live in. And the chatter has been that, you know, the Royals and Eric Hosmer are actively working to get a deal. You know, now, 2 years ago, before the World Series, you know, there was kind of was it before the World Series season, or I can't remember when it was exactly, but there's, you know, there was a time where talk of a Hosmer extension kind of heated up just a little bit, you know, but you didn't hear the same type of rumors. It was more that the Royals really wanted to try and get him locked up before all this became an issue, and that Hosmer was content to let things play out. And I don't know if that was necessarily so much Hosmer as it was Scott Boras, because that's how Boras likes to roll. Regardless, you know, now you're hearing a little bit more chatter that both sides are interested. And you know, that's something that you don't normally hear from a Boras client, is that the sides are interested. And you know, obviously the Royals are going to say they're interested, because worst case scenario, you say, oh, well, we're interested and we offered Hosmer $100 million, but he signed for $150 million. There's nothing we can do. You know, if we offer somebody the highest contract we've ever offered anybody and they get more money somewhere else, you know, sorry.
Right. What are you going to do?
You know, yeah, this the Hosmer situation is the easiest thing in the world for the Royals to handle. You know, the only The only issue for the Royals, I guess, at this point, or if the Royals were to assume Hosmer doesn't sign, the only issue would be, okay, what's the number that we actually offer him that we know he would not accept, but that still seems like we really want
right.
Like, oh, we offered $125 million, but at what point do you actually offer something that he then just says that he accepts, that you don't actually want to pay? You know, that's like the only risk. But regardless, you know, there's all these rumors heating up. And something that I believe it was Seren Petro that may have brought up, and that Clint Scholes kind of echoed to us, that was very interesting. And that was a point that I had never really kind of thought about this way. But as Clint had mentioned, rarely in this regime of Dayton Moore and his front office that he's run with the Royals, does information like this come out about a player and about signing an extension, and there doesn't end up being an extension. You know, there doesn't end up being a deal that gets done. Dayton Moore and his crew run a very tight ship. They're very selective with the information that they allow to leak out. If they don't want it to leak out, it typically does not. So the idea that, you know, the Royals would essentially or seemingly allow this information to be out there almost makes you think maybe the deals are closer than we thought, you know. And it could be possibly, maybe it's something that the Royals had no control over, and maybe it's Boris and his camp leaking to drum up interest from other teams. You know, it seems a little early to try and start that before the season he becomes a free agent. You know, so it would be kind of an odd tactic, but Boris has done this type of thing before, so you never really know. But it's really kind of interesting when you put it that way, and it's absolutely right. When word leaks about these types of rumors, Dayton Moore has not missed his guy. He has gotten his man, you know, just about every time that I can really recall. So, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. And then you have the question of Eric Hosmer, and what's his value on the open market, and what's his true value? What's he truly worth? Or I should say, let's back up, rephrase it. What is he worth, and what will some team be willing to pay him? Because as we've seen in baseball, there's this kind of somewhat arbitrage model, if you will, that the players union has created, where if you put all the a player's stats down on paper and just looked at it, you might say, okay, this player is worth X dollars. And then you put a face on there and you say, oh, well, this player was actually, you know, David Ortiz or whatever. You know, you put a recognizable face on that, on that piece of paper. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, we're going to give $30 million more than what we previously said. You know, there's this kind of, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a David Ortiz, but just in baseball, there's, you know, at the top end, especially though, there really seems to be a really wide chasm of what or I should say more at the kind of second tier, not necessarily top end, because a lot of the top end players are actually worth their salt. You know, Mike Trout is worth every bit of what he's going to get. And, you know, Clayton Kershaw is probably worth $30 million a year, you know, based on the dollars per war metric, if that's the most simplest one to go off of. So the question is Hosmer worth what he's going to get paid? No one really knows. A lot of people think, you know, somewhere in the 120 to 150 range seems pretty reasonable. I tend to think that sounds good for not necessarily what he's worth, but what he will get. So, you know, what can the Royals do? Can the Royals afford that type of contract? Is that something that the Royals want to do? Is Eric Hosmer worth that much? I mean, when you hear these things, where do you come out on this whole situation?
Well, I know obviously Hosmer has been a big part of the organization. I mean, clearly, he was pretty much the guy who ushered in the whole, you know, emergence of the farm system and you know, the big walk-up crowd that day in May in 2011. I mean,
that was there.
Huge. And that was like the announcement to everyone that, hey, these guys are coming. And then, you know, lo and behold, a few years later, the Royals finally win the World Series. And Hosmer is a significant part of that. But like, the weird thing for me is like, I mean, you can look at Hosmer and compare him to other first basemen, and you can definitely say, you know, he's not in the same class as a Cabrera, as a Pujols, as, you know, guys like that. He's not. You know, 25 homers was his career high. He's only surpassed 20 homers once. It's not like he's a guy hitting 320 every year or walking a lot. You know, people are the metrics hate his defense. I kind of get some of that, but I think he's better than the metrics say. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's tough to put any kind of number on him because he's a really different player from a lot of those guys. He's not your prototypical first baseman who's going to, you know, hit 250, but hit 40 out or, you know, challenge for a batting title. So I don't really know how to value him. I'm looking at what guys who play first base signed for this year. And like Edwin Encarnacion, who's significantly older, got 3 years and $60 million from the Indians. And that's, you know, about $20 million a year for a guy like that. So if that's the bar you're setting, I don't know where, I guess that would put Hosmer, who's making about $12.5 million, I think it is, for this year in his last year of arbitration. Yeah, I mean, maybe does that settle him into 16 to 18 million a year for being younger, you know, with some playoff experience, with some, you know, some of the intangible marketing clubhouse kind of stuff to him? Is that something that, that kind of works in his favor? I look at like Ian Desmond, who's, you know, a little bit older than Hosmer. He's 31. Hosmer's going to be 28 this year. Desmond, who's pretty much been shortstop and an outfielder, is going to play first base for the Rockies for some reason. 5 years, $70 million. So that's probably, I mean, Hosmer's probably good to make more than that. So I don't know where to value him because he's such a different player from the typical, but it's not like he has an element where he is particularly great at. You know, he's pretty good and he has stretches where he looks like a world beater. He looks like he's going to crush everything. And then there are times where he gets antsy, he swings at stuff that he shouldn't, he doesn't make contact as well. He hits a ton of ground balls. So I'm not sure. Now, if the Royals have a, you know, secret weapon and they know that he's working on elevating the ball and he's not going to hit the ball on the ground 55% of the time, if they know that he's going to hit a bunch of fly balls and they're going to turn into home runs, yeah, maybe they should lock him up right now. But then it gets into the question of how long do you sign him, how much per year. And for Hosmer, I think that, you know, the number that came out was like 10 years. And I don't think the Royals are going to do that where they lock a guy up for 10 years. I can't see that. I can't see them going for that kind of a deal, especially when it's someone who you feel comfortable with but isn't like a lock. You know, when Alex Gordon was going to be a free agent, it was like, okay, he's had all these different all-star years. He's been solid, you know, great in the clubhouse. You know, a lot of the same intangible kind of things, but you had more of a track record of consistent success, high-level success, you know, standing out in his position kind of stuff from Alex Gordon that you didn't necessarily have with Hosmer all the time. And that's, you know, first base is place where the guys who can kind of play defense but really hit end up playing. So it's a tough crowd for him. But I don't know if that means that he's more likely to do 6 years or 8 years or what. I don't know what the deal is that works for him that you know, significantly pays him what he and his agent Scott Boras feel he's going to be worth, but, you know, still leaves him some opportunity to grow. Because like, the two options that I see for him are either go to free agency or you lock up that big, you know, 8 to 10 year deal. I just don't see the Royals doing 8 to 10 years. Otherwise, I would see more likely that he's going to go and get like, as a free agent, get like 3 year deal and come back out at age 31 and see if he can cash in again after 3 good years in the right spot. You know, the deal that always kind of seemed right to me was he would end up going to like New York, getting like a 7 year deal with an opt out after the 3rd year. So he can just go hit homers in that short porch and right, and then opt out, hit the market again, at age 31. You know, that makes sense to me. That makes sense for something he might do. And maybe if there is an actual extension with the Royals, maybe it's something like that where he can, you know, cash in with some certainty now and then still be able to test the market later. But I don't see it. I just don't see where, you know, the years are going to come up to where they're going to go ahead and commit that amount of money to him. Even if he has all these good things and checks all the boxes on the checklist for what they might want, and they feel comfortable with whatever his offensive production is, I don't see how it's going to happen. Even if, you know, he's making mention of it. I mean, it's like, it's not just that the information's coming out; it's coming directly from him, which is, you know, like concrete discussion of, oh, we've kind of talked about this. Like, that's pretty unique for, you know, for a player with this organization to be talking about it that just openly. And, you know, you're right. I can't think of an example of a guy who they talked about locking up with an extension that they didn't end up getting. I mean, you look down the list, you know, Billy Butler, Zach Greinke, Joaquin Soria back in the day, Alex Gordon, Alcides Escobar, Billy Butler, I think I said him already. You know, Ventura, you know, Duffy, you know, just numerous guys that they've targeted and extended and kept around. And so I can't see it being anything much different from the scope of those kind of deals with Hosmer. And if it's only a 3 or 4 year extension, I don't know why he'd have incentive to take it unless it was at like $20 million a year, which I don't see the Royals being able to do or trying to do. So I'm not really sure what deal materializes in all of this. And I think the rest of the internet is perplexed too, because, you know, a lot of people, depending on who you ask, some will be like, yeah, I can see where the breakout might come. And some of them are like, well, he's been around since 2011. I don't know how he's going to change from what he is now, which is inconsistently average. Maybe a touch above average in the right spot. So I don't know. I'm kind of lost. I'm surprised, and I'll be even more surprised if he actually does sign an extension to stick around. So I don't know where it goes from here.
I think there are a couple interesting things at play here, which, as you mentioned, you know, inconsistently average type of a player.
And don't get me wrong, some of the metrics always been one of my favorites, but, you know, I know,
right, you know, and he has moments of MVP caliber greatness. The first half of 2016, the All-Star game, I mean, that was legitimate, like, you know, MVP type level production, you know. And then he, as you mentioned when you at the beginning of your point, he just disappears, and just, it seems like he maybe struggles for a game, maybe a couple games, a week or so, and then he wants to get it all back in one swing, and then he Fs his swing up, and then he has to try and fix it and tinker with it and get all the way back to where it works, and it just ends up making the thing even worse. You know, when you look at a player like Miguel Cabrera, you know, the dude never changes anything. He might go cold for, you know, a month. Last season he had some rough spots, but, you know, he's always solid. He always is so calm. He's always knows exactly what he's looking for. Sometimes it's working for him, or sometimes it's not working for him. The majority of the time it is, though. And so when it's not working for him, those tend to be less frequent and smaller when it does, fewer when it does happen, because he maintains that consistency. Hosmer does not do that. And that's been his biggest issue, I think, offensively. And, you know, the metrics defensively don't necessarily like him. So, you know, knowing all that, but then knowing what we have, or what the Royals know, which is he's the face of the franchise. Everyone loves him. The town loves him. His locker room presence is impeccable. Not a single person has said a bad thing. They've all said, you know, great things about his leadership ability, how much he's respected, and the clubhouse. Everyone looks to him in the clubhouse. You know, Salvi is kind of the heart and soul of the team, and Gordon's that kind of, you know, lead by example, you know, the sage elder, if you will. But Hosmer is the chosen, you know, he sits upon the Iron Throne as far as Royals Kingdom is concerned, you know. So
first of his name.
And I mean, yes. I mean, would you disagree with that assessment?
Yeah, I mean that's the guy. I mean that's he's on the,
and that's what the Royals wanted. That's what they've wanted.
Yeah, he's the guy on the video game box. I mean that's who they are. I mean baseball's a weirdly unmarketed sport sometimes for like individual guys, like compared to the NBA, the NFL. But like Hosmer's one of those guys who stands out. You know, he's in that group.
Yeah, and so knowing all that, that is who, you know, how much of a premium do the Royals place on those things? You know, and there's still also this hint of Hosmer's only 27, so he's now kind of entering his true prime. So if he's, you know, there's still ceiling to reach there. And if he's able to not only reach that ceiling, which I think he probably has for short periods, but if he's able to reach that and get to a point where he's consistently performs at that level for an entire season, you know, then obviously he's worth what he's most likely going to get paid. But you know, assuming he doesn't and he just kind of maintains being the player that he is, how much of a premium beyond what he's actually worth are the Royals willing to pay because of all this other stuff that they know is great for the Royals organization, for the city, all that kind of a thing? Yeah. You know, I don't necessarily know the answer to that question, but that's one of the factors that's in play. And I think the second factor that's in play for me that I like, that I often wonder about, and you can give me your thoughts on this, from a player standpoint, is it the annual value that they want the most out of the contract, or is it the total value? Now, if you're in football, you're in the NFL, you want that annual value, you want that guaranteed money, because the total, you know, Justin Houston signed $102 million contract a couple of years ago. He's not going to see all that money. He's going to see a lot of it, but he's not going to see all of it.
It's just not guaranteed. Yeah.
In baseball, the day you sign it, it's guaranteed unless your name is Gil Mesh.
Right.
He gave his back. That was voluntary. Yeah,
gave it a wink, wink, yeah.
Right. But so, you know, if you sign on the dotted line, you get all that money. So if you're the Royals, you know, and Hosmer, you say, okay, Hosmer is going to go out and he's going to sign a 7-year deal for $125 million. 130, make a nice round.
So number, 18, 19 million on average. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that seems about right probably for what Hosmer, or not necessarily what Hosmer is, but what I think he'll get on the open market. So do you go from there and do you say, okay, well, we'll give you, we'll give you $130 million, but let's make it 10 years. So now he's only making $13 million a year, which is like about what Danny Duffy's making, you know, and, you know, less than what Alex Gordon is making, but it's guaranteed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 10 years from now, Hosmer will be 37. The last 2-3 years of those contract, he's going to have kind of his Mike Sweeney kind of tip the cap fade out years where he just DHs the whole, you know, the majority of the time and then, you know, kind of rides off into the sunset. So knowing that's your scenario, I mean, is that something that, you know, does Eric Hosmer say, I'm okay with that? I'll take the extra 3 years to stay in Kansas City because that's 3 more years I don't have to worry about anything.
Right.
You know, if you were to take a 7-year contract, you'd make more money in a short period. But then there's no guarantee as a 34, right, 35-year-old, you know, maybe he has to find – maybe he ends
maybe
up
signing – maybe he's really in the Mike Sweeney years and he has to bounce between Seattle and Philly.
Exactly.
Yada, yada, yada.
You know, and he's, you know, signing a 2-year, you know, $8 million deal or something. You know, I mean, are you really going to net that much extra? So, you know, that's something that I've always kind of wondered about. You know, if it's – since the contracts are guaranteed, you know, why not? You know, if you're going to get – you know, that unknown is that extra that 3-year gap. You know, you have the certainty of if you were to take the Royals deal in this hypothetical equation and you know you're going to get the $13 million for all 3 of those years. That's $39 million. So, you know – do you take the same money for the 7 years and then say, I guess, you know, theoretically you would, you know, you're going to get some money probably as a 35-year-old.
Yeah.
So I guess it's, you know, kind of worth it to, cause you would end up with more money in the aggregate. But I don't know, at the same time, you know, it's like, hey, I signed a $130 million contract. I'm, you know, super rich, and I could spend my whole career in Kansas City. I can go down as, you know, a favorite son, maybe have my name retired or my jersey retired. Who knows? So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I've ever been able to truly kind of get a handle on whether baseball players really want that annual value or want that overall.
My guess, and like the only thing I'm basing this on, are like two of the bigger contracts we've seen recently are like, you know, Albert Pujols when he left the Cardinals and Robinson Cano when he left the Yankees, and they went for those big kind of deals. And a team might go for that kind of deal when it's an elite guy, kind of understanding and expecting even that the latter years, the last maybe even 4 years, you're probably going to have an average, maybe even less than that kind of player. But if they're good enough to be well above average for the first 4 years, in the neighborhood for the middle two, and then the sharp decline starts, well, you probably get your value on the front end of it and in the middle of it, and then you just kind of get by later. So I don't know. I think teams, it probably just depends on the player. I mean, there's not a lot of guys who can go out there and say, you know, 10-year contract's half a career or most of a career. We're talking about Nolan Ryan. He played, 27, 25 years? I mean, yep. 10 years is a chunk. So it's, I don't know. I mean, I think you'd have to really have the money be right. If I'm Hosmer and I know where salaries are going, and he's got Boris, so Boris knows where salaries are going, I would, you know, take my chances on, you know, down the line. I don't know. I just, it's weird. I can't imagine. I would say he'd be more likely and probably more beneficial to him to take like a 5-year deal and then kick out, be a couple years younger and still maybe be able to get another 5-year deal. But by that point, average salaries will have jumped up still some more. And so, you know, maybe that's more beneficial in the end. I don't know. I don't know. I can't figure it out. And Hosmer complicates things because, you know, he's not a guy who's would normally be in that kind of discussion. I think the 10 years just kind of came up somewhere. He said later that he didn't say anything about 10 years. So I don't know. But still, the fact remains that he's probably looking to try to, you know, 7 years, 6 years, probably about a starting point for something like that. You know, he's probably looking as an extension for whatever he would be looking for as a free agent, with maybe 1 year added on, you know, just to cover this year. You know, so I don't know what that ends up adding up to. I also don't think that it's going to work for the Royals to do it unless it's like a 3-year extension on this, you know, final year. So like a four-year contract that carries him through 3 free agent years. That's all I can really see the Royals doing. Anything more than that, I'd be really surprised.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's always the opt-out
sure.
discussions.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're the Royals, you say, okay, here's a 10-year contract, and this is your average value, but, you know, we'll give you after 4 years, you can opt out. So when he's 32, you know, or 31, maybe he decides he wants to opt out. And he, you know, it's possible at that age you could be coming off your best season and you could get, you know, a nice 5 or 6 year contract for maybe $20 million a year again. So kind of double down on that type of thing. Jason Hayward's contract was structured similarly, yeah. That he signed last year for the Cubs. So, who knows? Lots of things, you know, lots of possibilities there, and you know, we've probably already talked about it longer than it's really worth talking about.
I think in the end,
you know, nothing's going to happen. Yeah, I mean, nothing's going to happen soon with Eric Hosmer. It would probably be during the season, I would guess, if anything.
Well,
if he gets to free agents,
if they were going to do it, it was going to be before opening day, which that's the Royals' MO too. Oh. They usually won't work on that stuff during the year.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, we'll see, yeah. I guess. But, you know, if Hosmer hits free agency, there's no way he's signing here. Because some team is going to pay him way more than the Royals will.
I think so.
So So yeah, I think with that we've covered all the pertinent Royals news since we've been done here and there, since we've been on hiatus, if you will, the last couple of weeks.
Sorry, so, that's my bad.
we'll leave. No big deal. I had a little time off for the little baby last year, so we all need a little break from the podcasting, but we're coming into the season.
It is now. Yeah, it's
so we will be here, and we're still ironing out the details, but we are going to have a watch party at Kelly's soon, so stick with us for that. We'll get you the details on all of that once we get everything ironed out for, you know, what game is going to be, what the day is going to be.
I have an idea, but we haven't finalized it yet.
Yeah, we haven't confirmed everything with them, so we want to just make sure it's all good before we start pumping it up and telling you guys to come out. So stay tuned for that, and we certainly will keep you posted.
And Kelly's redid their website, too. It's pretty cool. So
boom,
you know,
there it is. So be sure to visit Kelly's even when we don't have a watch party there.
Kelly's
WestportIn.com. Indeed. Go to bpkansascity.com while you're on the interwebs as well. Read some fantastic stuff from the great group of writers we have there. Lots of fun things happening baseball prospectus in general right now, and of course that feeds over into the great stuff we're doing on BP Kansas City. So be sure and hit that site up as well, and stick with us as we get it's coming here. It's already baseball weather right now. It's early baseball weather, so hopefully, you know, all we're missing is the actual baseball. But spring training games are going to start soon. And then shortly after that, the season will be here. And man, oof, the anticipation for this season, more so even than after 2014, where they came so close and the whole team was intact coming back for 2015, even more so than that, there's so much pressure, it feels like, on this season. And I hope it doesn't adversely affect the team, but you can really feel it, you know, and I the organization knows it. You can hear it when the guys talk, you know, like Lorenzo Cain, especially. I heard an interview with him, and, you know, he's, you know, they're consummate professionals. They're saying the right things, but you hope it doesn't have an adverse effect on the team. But it's definitely there, you know. So regardless, hopefully they respond well, and we have another exciting Royals season with a playoff run at the end that whoever does end up leaving after this season, you know, it will be a good send off for all of them. So until then, that's kind of down the road, but we've got a lot of Royals baseball in between now and then, and we'll be here for all of it. So stick with us for that. Thank you all so much for listening. Visit Kelly's, go to bpkansascity.com. Keep listening to the show throughout the season, and we'll be back next week. But until then, thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.